Our first 10-minute speaker is Jessica.
Hi, my name's Jessica. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 20th, 2005. My sponsor's Amy D. My grand sponsor's Mark P. And I'm a member of Atlantic Group. And let's see now. So I have just over 2 years. And born in 1986, so just so you all don't have to think about that, I'm 21 years old, and I got sober when I was 19. Let's see. Well, I've only got 10 minutes to tell you guys what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born into a family, two older brothers, and followed by four younger brothers, and two loving parents who are still together, born into a Christian home. And, you know, I grew up going to church every Sunday. There were no ifs, ands, and buts about it. You know, I grew up not really listening to what was being said, but just knowing that, you know, that God existed and God did something for my parents, because, you know, every once in a while I heard them speak funny. You know, they spoke in my dad spoke in tongues, which I still don't understand to this day, and don't try to, but, you know, and that was the God of my not really understanding. And, and wow, I'm funny. and so let's see, when I was 16, let's actually start a little bit further back than that, because let's face it, I was an alcoholic from the day I was born. You know, I don't believe that growing up in a big family where I never really, you know, big family full of boys where I never really felt a part of or really knew where I fit in, that didn't really make me an alcoholic. That might have contributed to some things, but let's see now. You know, I never really felt like I fit in anywhere. You know, I was you know, awkward, and I would have given anything to be anyone else. you know, my entire life. And when I think I was 12 years old, I took a trip out west with my family, and it was for my cousin's wedding. And I get there, and you know, they had four different kinds of alcohol. I remember very distinctly. I never drank alcohol before, and I remember they had two different types of beer and two different wines. And so, what did I do? I was feeling very awkward, and walked up to the bartender, smiled, and he gave me a beer. And I tried drinking it, and I hated it, and I tried, you know, as many sips as I could, and it was just awful. And so I took it back, or I gave it to my brother, and went back and got the other kind of beer, and he just kind of laughed and gave it to me. I tried drinking that. It was disgusting. So I gave it to, you know, I put it down, and I went back, and I got, you know, the wine, and that was terrible. You know, I tried drinking as much of that as I could. It didn't go down too easy. So I went back and I got, you know, the other kind of wine. You know, I was relentless. I just, you know, and this is me, 12 years old, never having a drink of alcohol before in my life. And what happened then was, you know, it was the middle of a sunny afternoon, and I just immediately, I felt freer. I knew that this was it. Like, this is what I was looking for my entire life. Like, I never wanted to be, you know, I always wanted to be something else. You know, I always wanted what everyone else had, and this, you know, this was it. And I took off my sandals, and I was skipping along, and my mom goes, "She's drunk," and I was like, "No, I'm not." You know, I didn't feel drunk. I felt great. You know, like it was sunnier, and I was prettier, and I was, you know, my dress was, you know, had more flowers on it, and like, you know, I felt great, okay, and, you know, and I went back to the, to my aunt's house where we were staying, and I just remember sitting, laying on the floor and just thinking about the drink, you know, obsessing over this drink and where I could get more, you know, and that's, that was, you know, the first time I drank. So fast forward that to, you know, the next time I drank was a little bit different. I was, you know, I just, you know, I was broke into my friend's parents' liquor cabinet and, you know, they had about 10 or 11 different kinds of liquor and that. And before I even had my first sip, I knew that there wasn't going to be enough, you know, and, you know, sickness and blacking out. And that was, you know, right from the beginning. And what happened? Well, this is a progressive disease, and my alcoholism progressed. And you know, it wasn't always that I blacked out every time. You know, I just when I picked up the drink, when I picked up that first drink, I never knew if that was going to be it, if I was going to be able to have, you know, a couple glasses of wine with dinner and go home, go to sleep, or if you know, that was going to lead to other things, and it began to lead to other things, and I mean, more drinking, and you know, and then it just then one day I had, you know, I'd had enough, you know, it was too painful. And I mean, I'm not going to go too much into my drunkologue because you guys, I'm sure, can all relate, or else you wouldn't be in this room. But you know, I'm going to blank. You know, one day I woke up and I had enough. So, you know, I got rid of everything I had. You know, that was it. It was ruling me, and I had no control on it anymore. And so I got rid of it. And great, that was that, all gone. You know, and it wasn't all gone, because the next, you know, a couple days later, you know, when that obsession picked up again, you know, what did I do? My first instinct, I went right back to the drink. And you know, that happened a couple times for me, and then I can remember so clearly my last time drinking was, you know, it was a big mess, and I woke up in the morning and just you know, I can't really tell you why this day was any different. I just remember walking through Washington Square Park and just thinking, like, just seeing this being my life, like spiraling down and down, and thinking that something had to change, and so I, you know, I made a decision that I was powerless over alcohol. Like, I had no power. Like, I had wanted to stop in the past, and that was, you know, I didn't know what to do, and you know, I had. God, I wish I had more time than 10 minutes now. you know, and I just, you know, I was powerless. And so I put down the drink, and fear kept me sober. You know, like, I did not want to lose it all. You know, I didn't want to lose everything that I'd worked for. I didn't want to, you know, have to start over, and I saw my motivation and everything slipping out the window, you know, and even though I was so young, and so fear kept me sober for, you know, for a couple months, and fear and a boyfriend. And this, you know, this boy was, you know, people say, and I really, really believe this, I truly believe this, that, you know, God speaks through other people, and even if, you know, even if that other person, you know, is in and out of your life, like, you know, that person really, you know, it might be God, you know, speaking through that other person. And this man was, you know, had a couple years sober, and he was going to these things called meetings, And, you know, I went, he brought me to my first meeting, and new people took me in, and you know, I got a sponsor, and she really helped me work the steps, and, you know, this, you know, because I, once I put down that drinking, you know, my thinking was still there, and, you know, this program and AA and my and God and my sponsor and you guys have all, you know, given me the life that I'm living today. So thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Jimmy F.
Gratitude. I knew it was going to happen. My name is Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic. Like to thank you, Jessica, for speaking. Jessica said she was 19 when she came in to get sober. I was 55 when I came in to get sober. I got 10 years now. and I'm overwhelmed right now with gratitude. I didn't come in this way. You know, my sobriety date is September the 22nd, 1997. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Joel. I say today the gift that they've given me is I dance with God today in 10, 11, and 12. And when I came in here on my knees. I was a broken soul. I was hurting. I'm one of those park drunks. I always say, come from park bench to park avenue. You know, that's the way I drunk. I drunk in the park, and if you see me, you probably see me falling out on a bench or under a bench. Or if you rode the subways, you might have seen this guy who was laying on the subway, stretched out, thought that he was home, you know, and you was on your way to work, you know, and you probably said to yourself, look at this guy. He's taking up all of this room. Why don't he get up and get a job? You know, I want to thank Helen for asking me to speak because it gave me time to reflect a little bit about. I didn't really get a working job until I was 30. I did a lot of drinking. Most of you might not remember when the Third Avenue L was up. It's a little before your time, but I used to go down on the Bowery when the Bowery really was the Bowery. You know, it didn't have the condominiums and things. And I used to go down there, and I used to drink with these guys. They used to drink Muscatel, and we used to go to these little speakeasy joints, you know what I mean? It was like 10 cents a glass, and we go in there, and I drink with them, you know? At that particular time, the Salvation Army was around, and they were trying to sober people up. And we didn't know much about AA, just like I didn't know much about AA. My last drunk was, I got off work. I went around the corner. I brought myself a pint of rum, and I was sitting on the stoop, and I ran into someone, and we started talking, and the next thing I know, I wound up uptown. I was on 137th Street, and I was in a vacant building, and I was standing in the middle of the floor, and I was buck naked, and I didn't know why I was there. All I knew is I was waiting for some female to come along with some substance that I didn't use. I actually had to find my way down. Of course, I didn't know how to get down, and she brought me down. And we came down the fire escape. So I like to say I came from a place where there were no steps, and I stumbled into a place where they had 12 steps. You know, 12 steps of Alcoholic Anonymous. And the way that I got here, I used to drink pretty heavy, like I said. I was drinking on a job, and we had a little Italian guy, me and Eddie. We used to run up and down Queens on Steinway Street, and we used to drink, you know. We stop off at all of these little bars, and we had a good time. And so one day I come to work, and the boss said, I think Eddie's having a problem with drinking. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, and people are saying that they smell alcohol on his breath. Well, I mean, we all drunk, you know. Eddie was drinking, I was drinking, the foreman was drinking. But they said we need to do something about it. What do you think we should do? And they recommended sending Eddie to a rehab. And Eddie went off to a rehab, and 28 days later, Eddie came back from the rehab, and I was in the office, and Eddie said to me, he said, Jimmy, he said, give me a drink. And I said to him, I said, what are you talking about, Eddie? I said, you just got out of rehab. I mean, you just spent 28 days up in rehab. You know you're not supposed to drink. I said, they got you on this pill called this Antabuse, you know. So there's no such thing as a magic pill that's going to stop you from drinking. And he said, no, no, Jimmy, he says, you don't understand. He says, I got the pills in there in this jar. And he showed me the pills of the Antabuse that were in the jar. So I figured, hey, you know, not knowing anything about AA, I'd give him a drink. He was one of the regular boys, so I went in my locker, I brought my fifth out, and I poured him a nice hookah. And Eddie took that drink, and when Eddie took that drink, instantly he blacked out, and I caught him, and I set him in a chair. And the first thing, when I looked into his eyes, there was nobody there, and it hurt me to my heart. I got really upset. I got mad. I started cussing at him. I started telling him he didn't know how to drink. You don't need to drink. You need to stop drinking. You're messing up my drinking, Eddie. You know, and he looked at me and he said with that look in his eyes, he said, you don't understand. It hurt. And I said, what is it I don't understand about drinking, Eddie? I said, I've been drinking for 45 years. You tell me what it is that I don't understand about drinking. And he looked at me and he said, Jimmy, he said, come to a meeting with me. And I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting with you. And I came to a meeting with Eddie that night. I came to the Atlantic Group, and it happened to be anniversary night. And as I came upstairs, we were on 91st Street, I see this lady walking across the hallway, you know. She had blonde hair, blue eyes, and she was wearing a mink coat. And she was talking, oh, darling, AA is so marvelous, it's wonderful, you know. You know, and I looked at this lady, and I said, whoa. And I walked over to her, and I said, are you for real, you know? And she said to me, she said, you must be a beginner, darling. I said, yes. She said, you know what? She said, you come up and sit in the front with me so that you'll get to hear the message, and you won't sit in the back and take people's inventory as they come in and out of the room. You know, I've been sitting next to Peggy for the last 10 years. But she also gave me a hat that said BW on it. It said Bill Wilson's University. You know, I never got a scholarship. I never graduated out of school. I remember I got kicked out of school because I was drinking a bottle of Ombre in my welding class, in my welding booth, and we had a bunch of guys in there, and we were shooting dice. And so I had to get out of school. But she said, you sit up front with me and you'll get to hear the message. I was figuring it out the other day. It must have been, I said, since I've been hearing people speak about 1,550 speakers come up before the Atlantic Group and speak, you know. And I only say this because of the beginners that are in the room, because when I came in here, I was really frightened. I was really broken. You know, I didn't know how to dress. You know, I came in with my little T-shirt on and sneakers on. Today, I wear a suit and a tie when it's appropriate for me to wear a suit and tie, because I like representing AA, you know. And I heard this guy, he was up in front of the room, you know, and I had sat down with Peggy, and I was looking at this guy, and he was standing in front of the room, and he was saying something like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. Whoa, wait a minute. this guy, the first drink that gets you drunk, the first drink never got me drunk. It might have been the last drink. What is this guy talking about? It's the first drink that gets you drunk. He says, yep, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And when I was looking at him, I noticed the two buttons above his belt weren't buttoned. So I knew he was an alcoholic, you know? So I said, because I've been on the Bowery, and I, like I said, I drunk with a lot of guys down on the Bowery, and I knew about these guys. They were doctors, lawyers, and things like that, and I never really could understand what alcoholism was back then, like I understand it now. But anyhow, this guy's name was Clancy, right? And he says, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. Now, and I said, all of a sudden, I meet this lady. She's gliding across the floor like a nut. Now, and I got another nut standing in front of me, you know what I mean, telling me it's the first drink that gets you drunk. But then he said something that caught my ear. He said, we have a disease, and it's called alcoholism. Now, I've been drinking all of this time trying to figure out what it was that was wrong with me, why it was every time I said that I was only going to have one drink, I always would be sitting at the bar, the bartender would be flicking lights, and he would be hollering, last drink. And I had a bad habit of telling the bartender, give me a triple. And he would say, we don't serve triples. He would say, I'd say, give me two doubles, a beer, and my friend will be out of the bathroom in a minute. And by the time he brought that out, I'd be spinning around and twisting around in the daisy, going, not going home, but going downtown to Delancey Street to see a friend of mine that had a mattress in the back of the subway, and I used to go down and spend the night with him instead of going home. So, I also heard some good information. They said, get a sponsor. Get a home group so you won't be homeless. Well, when I came into AA, I was homeless and I didn't have a sponsor. I got me a sponsor and his name is Joel. Joel said to me, he said, Jimmy, he says, we're going to read the big book. And when we get through, you should be joyous, happy, and free. Now, I don't know what freedom is for a lot of you, but I know today that when I wake up in the morning, I don't have to run into the living room and pick up some substance to alter my thinking. The first thing I do today is I meditate for an hour and I get down on my knees and I say a prayer and I thank God. Now, the program isn't truly about the fellowship. It's truly nice to fellowship and have friends, but it's about doing the work. And one day Joel said to me, he said, we're going to work on your fourth step. And I looked at him and I said, what are you talking about? We're going to work on the fourth step. He said, we're going to deal with some of your resentments. And I said, I don't have no resentments. You know, he says, no, let's take a look and see. And so we begin to work on my fourth step, and when I got to look at it, I remember one night I was on my way home, and I was terrified because I heard this screaming and this noise down at the end of the block. And I didn't want to go down to the end of the block. I was petrified, my heart was beating fast, but I decided, well, I'd go down to the end of the block. And when I got down to the end of the block, I seen it was my mother, and she was fighting with an ex-boyfriend, and my sisters and my little brothers were out there, and I blacked out. A light just clicked right off, and the next morning I woke up, I was in prison. And I couldn't figure out why I was in prison. And I asked one of the inmates, I said, can you tell me why I'm in here? And he said, well, Jimmy, he says, I'll put it on the Y. That's sort of like a communication system that they have in prison. And he says, I'll find out why you're in here. When he came back, he told me, he said, well, you know, Jimmy, that night, I said, yeah. He said, you killed the man. Wow. That was devastated. It put me in a shell where I couldn't trust anyone, because if I could go out and do that, then I had no trust for anyone else. If I could take another human being's life, then I couldn't even trust myself. But me and Joe, we started working on that, and I took a good look at that. You see, it looked like I did the honorable thing, you know, protecting my family. You know, that sounds honorable and reasonable, that I was protecting my family. But when I really looked at it, I was a coward. But the thing about that is, I was operating out of self-centered fear. Most people don't understand what self-centered fear is. We operate out of self-centered fear. We do many things out of self-centered fear, but we're not even aware of it. We don't even get in touch with what it's about. We think sometimes it's the honorable thing to do, you know. Like when leaving a girlfriend, I remember a girlfriend was putting me down, and the first thing I said, well, you know, there are more fish in the sea. But I wasn't even honest about that, because the truth was, it hurt. And there was a lot of things in my life that went on that really hurt it, that I had compounded and pushed within myself. And I was operating out of those fears, that self-centered fear, that I wasn't beginning to live. I didn't know what it was to live. I didn't know what it was to be free. And then I had to make some amends, you know, and I went to my mom's and I had to make amends with my mom's, because I thought she didn't know how to pick out men, you know. Everyone she picked out seemed as though he was a drunk. And I sat down with my mom, and she was a beautiful lady. We danced at her funeral. We had a wonderful time because she prepared us for it. She was a very religious lady. And she said, you know, she said, have you ever seen a lioness in the jungle when she has her cubs? She says, the only thing that lioness thinks of are her cubs, and she takes care of them at all costs. You know, I said to myself, she could have put me in a trash can, she could have flushed me down the toilet, but she didn't do that. She did the best she could with what she had. So that resentment, if you have a resentment towards your mother, give it up. They do the best they can, because you know why? Because we never really stop to ask them what their story is. We always operate out of our own self-centeredness, our own selfishness about what they didn't do for us. And I went to my old man and I said, you know, Pop, I said, you wasn't there when I was young. I said, what happened to you? You know, I could have been a different person if you were there. But he used to always tell me, he was there when I went to prison. You know, he showed up and he did the best he could for me. But I was talking with him and I asked him, I said, what was your story, Pop? And he said, you know, son, he used to tell me, he said, right now, he said, you're not old enough, you know. He said, when you become a man, he said, you come to me and you ask me about it and I'll tell you. So one day I walked up to him, I said, you know, Dad, I said, I'm a man now. I don't want to know your story as your son. I want to know your story as a man. And he said to me, well, son, you know, he said, it's like any other man. He said, you meet a woman, you know, you get together, and all of a sudden she comes and she tells you she's pregnant and she's going to have a baby, but you got something else to do. Which he said he had something else to do. He had to take care of his sisters and his brothers, which were younger than him. And I understood that. So I could give up a lot of that resentment, you know, that I was working out of not really understanding what was going on. And today, when I talk, you know, they say, like, find a higher power, you know. I have God in my life today. I choose to call him God. The 11th step said, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with a higher power. And like I said, in the mornings, I get up now and I meditate for an hour. And when I meditate, I mean, there's no silence. It just goes on and 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 on. But I sit there for an hour and I let it go on and on and on. And then after that hour is finished, I get down on my knees and I say the Lord's Prayer. I say, thank you, Lord. Thank you for the day. Thank you for keeping me sober. Thy will be done. You know, there's a great prayer by Christ, Jesus Christ. He used to tell his disciples, stay awake, be awake. And he used to go off into the mountains, you know, and meditate. And he would go off into the mountains and he would come back and his disciples would be asleep and he'd have to wake them up, you know. Moses went off into the mountain. Moses came back. He came back with the Ten Commandments. You know, Bill Wilson, he sat down and he wrote the 12 steps. Now, how much better can it get than that? You know, for this alcoholic anyhow, you know, that I follow that principle, of the 12 steps, from 1 through 12. That's the way it works, 1 through 12. You don't skip. You don't do a cafeteria style, figuring I'll do two today and one tomorrow. You go from 1 to 12, and I tell you, just like my sponsor used to tell me, if you go from 1 to 12, by the time you reach 12, you should have a spiritual awakening. And I believe that because I had a spiritual awakening. Rather it be the educational variety or whatever it is, I guarantee if you go through 1 through 12, you will have a spiritual awakening because it will give you the time to take a good look, which most of us really choose not to do, at ourselves. And once you can take a good, honest look at yourself and see what's really going on with you, I tell you, you will truly be joyous, happy, and free. And those people that were counting days, or the newcomers, or if you're here for the first time, it's like when I came in here, I was petrified. When I first seen the Atlanta group and I seen the joy that they were having and the fun that they were having and they were laughing, I turned around and I walked to the corner. But when I got to the corner, I took a good look and said, where am I going? Where am I going? I'm going right back? No. I'd rather take my chances in these rooms, you know, because I know in these rooms they reached out, especially in my home group. I always say in my home group, they love me, you know. Grand sponsor used to say they had a thing, we're going to love you until you can love yourself. He was a beautiful man, you know, but he was one of those guys that would, when you asked him a question, he didn't want to hear the story. He wanted to get right to the point. He would cut you off and say, whoops, let's not go to the story. Let's go right to the source. And I liked him. I enjoyed. That's what he was all about. And that's what it's about today. Let's not hear the story. Let's get to the source. You know, once we get to the source, then there's that freedom. I look out here today and I look at you and trust me, I see you. Each and every one of you. When I first came, you were just a haze. one big blur, and I couldn't see what was out there. Today I know what's out there. And especially for the women in AA, I want to thank them because they've taught me something. You know, society projects a thing about women that all you think about is when you see them is sex. But you know what? If you get beyond that first view, if you get beyond that first stigma, you'll see a beautiful woman there. You know, you'll see a human being there. You know, and that's what they taught me in AA, that beautiful women are in AA trying desperately to get their lives together. So, if you hear the 13th step, please, you know, do it outside. You know what I mean? Take it somewhere else, do it outside, because the women in here, I love them, and I know that what they're doing in here is trying to get their life together. And with that, I wanted to say, there was a saying, man looks for a truth to fit his reality. Given his reality, the truth doesn't fit. If you experience it, it's the truth. The same thing believed is a lie. In life, understanding is a booby prize. Thank you.